thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
It's Digital Campus number 64 for the 20th of December, 2010. The Year in Review, 2010. And it is time for the fourth annual Big Stories of the Year Roundup here on the Digital Campus podcast, something we love to do every December. I'm Dan Cohen, broadcasting from the Center for History and New Media, where it is a frosty day outside with a cataclysmic 1.5 inches of snow. We're recording a little bit later than we expected, but glad to have here in the hearth of the room. We have, of course, Amanda French, our newest addition as host of Digital Campus. Hey, Amanda.
Hi, Dan. I'm wearing a red velvet formal floor-length ball gown.
It is very nice. We noticed that on the red carpet, and thank you for dressing up. I am wearing a tux, at least on the top half. I have sweatpants on the bottom, but... Welcome back. We also have Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom. How's your tux fitting you today?
Not quite as well as it was last night at the holiday party.
Yes,
lots of food and drinks to be had.
Also coming off an excellent CH&M holiday party with a lot of food, drink, and mirth, and bad gifts. Vuvuzelas were traded. And also Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hey, I'm still smarting about somebody stealing that USB-controlled rocket launcher from me.
That was just the best. I know, that traded hands quite a bit. We have a process here at the center where you can steal other people's gifts, and the USB-driven rocket launcher was highly popular, although there were many excellent gifts. Well, let's dive right in. It's been a great year, 2010. And we decided to mix it up a little bit this year. Normally, we've done a countdown from 10 to... one top stories, but this time we're going to go around the horn and discuss one big flop that we saw this year, one big hit, and one story to watch for 2011. So let's kick right in. Amanda, what's your big flop of 2010?
Well, it's a medium-sized flop, but I have to say that the revolution so far has not happened in terms of libraries putting up a whole lot of resistance to insane journal publishing prices. So I got very incensed by and excited about the University of California system's protests against the Nature Publishing Group's attempts to raise their prices 400%. You know, basically that fizzled just a little bit. You know, apparently, there weren't huge boycotts of Nature publications. It wasn't, at least hasn't so far, been the enormous blow for open access that I hoped it would be. Apparently, University of California and Nature Publishing Group came to some agreement, which is more or less secret, and that's really all we know about it.
Yeah, I think I said on Twitter I was hoping this would go nuclear, but I guess that was... not to be expected. I assume that the faculty wanted their journals at the end of the day, and it was going to be hard really for everyone to go to war over this. Does highlight the continuing secrecy around these agreements with publishers, doesn't it?
Yeah, they're always, they're contract negotiations, and, there's a lot of pressure really on both sides, honestly, for to keep the actual prices secret and the actual terms of the deal secret. So, what was interesting about this, at least, was that it did get a lot of actual data out there about what the journal prices are. And, so that's good, at least.
Right. It's a great site that I saw this week, writetoresearch.org, that's organized by students. And it's the first site I've seen that really does a good job just visualizing the prices of these journals, mostly the scientific journals, but they've got a great video introduction that just shows the graph of journal prices against inflation, you know, up several 100% versus general inflation being something like 80% in the last 25 years. And then also even more damning, you know, name some journals, both well-known ones and some pretty marginal medical and science journals that cost tens of thousands of dollars. Pretty effective.
It just seems to me that there's this, it sort of illustrates that journals and libraries are kind of in this, you know, in this death struggle, you know, like they're in this kind of mutual suicide pact, it seems like, in a way. Like the journals need the libraries need the journals, everybody keeps raising their prices, nobody can really back down. And like, meanwhile, you know, we're starting to see alternatives, open access alternatives that aren't published through the normal channels and aren't distributed through the normal channels, which, you know, published through the presses and distributed through the libraries. They're published in different ways. They're distributed in different ways. And it seems while the libraries and the big publishers continue to you know, fight these battles, some of us, you know, I think many of the listeners of this podcast are, you know, busy getting on with it and coming up with new ways to disseminate scholarly information.
Yeah. Amanda, you were going to say something?
Well, yeah, I think there's data on this as well, about the decrease in individual subscriptions to scholarly journals. And I always wish that, you know, somebody would just come right out and say, look, if this is so important to you, maybe you should subscribe to it yourself.
Right.
Individually, you know, because you know, and hopefully there would be subsidies for those, you know, prices, you know, through grants, particularly since these are STM publications we're talking about. You know, but again, that didn't happen and doesn't look like it's going to happen. Libraries are going to, I gave a talk recently, actually, which I'm still revising to put up on my blog, but I gave a talk at Metro in New York City. Metro is the Metropolitan New York Library Council. And so I was talking to some librarians, and I used a phrase that went something like, this service ethic thing, get over it. You know, stop helping scholars so much, right? Because sometimes it becomes a little codependent. You know, I mean, libraries often, you know, there's everybody in libraries knows that a lot of scholars do not know how much these journals cost and do not make the connection between, hey, we provide these journals free labor and then our institution has to buy them back. And so I feel as though if people had to subscribe to them individually, they would learn that a little better.
Yeah. The incentives are just all screwing the entire system. Well, I guess that's also maybe something to watch for 2011. Mills, what's your big flop of 2010?
My big flop of 2010 is the demise of Delicious.
This is like late breaking news, isn't it?
Yeah, just like in the last day or two, Yahoo, the owner of Delicious, pulled the plug, and as part of their continuing efforts to stay in business, Yahoo's continuing efforts to stay in business. And so Delicious, which was, I don't know, what, 2 years ago, it was the coolest thing ever in social bookmarking. And it's
and used widely, you know, on campuses, right?
Oh, yeah.
Classes,
yeah. I mean, I was,
and,
you
know,
I
for the purposes of this podcast, it was important, right?
Yeah. And I was a big Delicious user, although I didn't use it in the social bookmarking way so I didn't ever take full advantage of the system, but it was the way that I saved all the web content that I was using for, I don't know, a year and a half or so.
Yeah.
And then
too.
This thing, I don't know, Dan, maybe you've heard of it. It's called Zotero that came along.
It sounds familiar. Yeah.
It's this weird kind of name, Zotero. But anyway, it sounds like Albanian.
It does
or something,
sound slightly Albanian. Yeah.
Albanish. But so when Zotero came along, then I just stopped using Delicious. And so I'm part of the problem, I guess, but Delicious is done. So for all of you out there who have been relying on this, what was a great system for keeping track of all your web content that you were using, best of luck with that, because it's over. And it underscores really the problem of you know, scholars depending on services that are owned by profit-making, or in the case of Yahoo, I guess, loss-making entities, because, you know, I'm sympathetic about Yahoo's need to balance their books, because they do have stockholders that they have to satisfy. What worries me is not Delicious, because I had migrated off of it. What worries me is Flickr, which is also by Yahoo. And boy, I'll tell you, if they pull the plug on Flickr, that's going to be really, really bad.
Oh, man, that's such a good point, particularly Flickr Commons, which I love so much. And as I was scanning through the stories over the past year that we covered on Digital Campus, I got reminded of a lot of things, one of which was that Flickr Commons a while ago had decided not to accept new partners till 2011.
Yeah, that's right.
So again, that's another thing to watch. But I just think Flickr Commons is hugely important.
I mean, I've been saying since Flickr Commons launched, and I hate to do, there's going to be a few I told you so's in the next couple of minutes.
It's okay, we get to do that. It's our podcast.
But, you know, I've been saying since the beginning, you know, Flickr Commons is wonderful, but it's, you know, it's a commercial service. And, you know, it's not just that they stopped taking new additions. They, you know, they sacked the person who started it. You know, George Oates, who's now, I believe, at the Internet Archive.
Yeah, that's
right.
But
they, you know, Yahoo doesn't have a commitment to cultural heritage. You know, it might be a nice channel for people to do some, you know, some interacting with the public and some kind of Web 2.0-y kinds of things. But as a digital strategy for libraries, archives, and museums, which it has kind of played into a kind of broader digital strategy that has, you know, that where there's, you know, sort of preservation language and stuff, it just isn't that. And I don't think we can kid ourselves that these commercial services are really places where we should invest an awful lot of our very precious, very limited resources. So I think this Delicious failure and, you know, the specter hanging over Yahoo and Flickr should give us all pause, that when we, you know, dedicate a couple of people at the Library of Congress to putting stuff up on Flickr, like, you know, are those resources better spent somewhere else? I think we just need to be mindful of that as we move forward with, you know, in this new environment.
Yeah, I think what disturbed me the most was how sort of casual this casting off of Delicious was, where, you know, it really was important. It made it on a lot of lesson plans for educational technology. And, you know, to hear the CEO of Yahoo effectively say, like, it had become tiresome for them, you know. I can't imagine they had an enormous team working on it. And, you know, it just strikes me as you know, sometimes the reason these things go away is really rather marginal, you know. Okay, Tom, we need to move on to you. What is your big flop of 2010?
Okay, another I told you so. My big flop of 2010 is Second Life.
Second Life.
You know, we heard...
Second Life.
Yeah, we heard...
We have been beating this drum for years, haven't we? Vindication in 2010.
You know, I think from, you know, from basically the time we started podcasting in 2007... you know, Second Life was a big story in some certain circles of, you know, educational technology, and a lot of universities, libraries, archives, and museums poured considerable resources into building up Second Life properties. You know, not necessarily cash, but certainly staff resources. And we heard earlier this fall, I believe, that Second Life is now going to start charging for educational purposes, and there's been an exodus of sorts from Second Life because of that. You know, this is again the risk of using commercial services that you know are free for now and exist for now, but don't have good migration paths. It's not easy to get your stuff out of Second Life, or actually, for that matter, you know, it's not terribly easy to get it out of Flickr in a way that would be useful to repurpose in a collections management system or in an archival system or other ways. You know, these and you know, companies, as they should, make decisions that for the benefit of their shareholders and their bottom line. And when the bottom line when the bottom line for the shareholders doesn't match the bottom line for the cultural heritage professional, you know, that's just too bad for cultural heritage and education. So, you know, that's again another example of a flop. And I told you so for 2010.
Well, Tom, let me ask you something, though. I mean, to me, Flickr Commons and Second Life are rather different things because, number one, it is a lot easier to get your data in and out of Flickr than it is Second Life. You know, it's not quite as closed a system. And the other thing is that Flickr just has so many users, whereas Second Life, it never seemed to me as though, you know, a whole bunch of people were going to be using it in a really mainstream way. So, you know, to take the other side for a second, I mean, I think it's really important, actually, for cultural heritage institutions to go where the people are, you know, which is why I like some of these efforts to put materials out there in places where the people already are. So what's your response
to
that? Sure.
I mean, I'm not – I first of all, I don't think there's a one-to-one equivalence between Second Life and Flickr. I wouldn't say that. I also because I do think you're right. I mean, Flickr is a much more open system. Although what I mean when I say it's not all that easy to get your stuff out, what I mean by that is, you know, so all of this interaction that happens on the Flickr site, where, you know, and people always kind of point to the examples where a commenter on a particular photo provides some key identification of a person in the photo, or provides some information, a date or other information that the institution didn't have previously. The problem with that is, you know, it's not easy to — you can get the photo back, but you already have the photo, right? What you can't get out easily is all that comments, like all that interaction happens on their site, and it's kind of locked into their site. There's no easy way to migrate that back to the benefit of the institution, of the institution's main systems. Now, as a place for, you know, public engagement and kind of ephemeral public engagement, sure, I think that's a valid point. But I think there's a story here about putting too much time into commercial properties that we should just know what we're doing when we're doing it, I guess, is what I would say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Tom, thank you for that big flop of 2010. You got your rant in. See, we need to tell our audience that we're getting all the rants in early in the podcast so we can have triumphant, you know.
I'm going to be totally upbeat for the rest of the podcast.
Okay, that sounds good. Well,
I'm going to spread the holiday cheer.
I'm going to mix in some happy songs behind your voice later in the podcast. Okay. I guess it's to me. My big flop. My big flop was a service that just a year ago everyone considered, you know, there were these incredible calls that this was the future of computing and communications on the internet. Of course, I am talking about Google Wave, which also saw its demise just recently, or I shouldn't say demise. It has been moved into the Apache Software Foundation, as has become Apache Wave. For people who had totally forgotten about the maelstrom over Google Wave when it launched, this was, of course, Google's attempt to leap ahead, several generations ahead of email, IM, social networking, etc., and creating the most complicated interface I have ever used on a computer, I believe, maybe since the TRS-80. I couldn't figure it out. I think everyone else couldn't figure it out. And so late this year in 2010, they sacked it. And everyone was so excited that it has joined the Apache, of course, Apache Software Foundation, which runs the Apache web server, which runs 2/3 of the web. But it is in what's called their incubator. And I sort of checked this out to see, well, how alive is Wave now that it's moving over into the Apache incubator, which is sort of like its startup area. And it actually joins 30 other projects, including such exciting projects as Apache Chukwa, Apache Droids, and Apache Wookie. And as you can tell, for instance, Droids is a intelligent standalone robot framework. So this is definitely the home of geeks, as it should be. And maybe that's where Webb should have gone to begin with, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm a little sad about Wave. I mean, I never really grokked it, to be honest, and I never certainly.
Thank you for using that very geeky word there.
Yeah, I thought I'd throw that in.
Yeah,
I certainly never really used it. But I do think there was something to the idea of, kind of bringing all your different kinds of communications, instant messages, longer form writing, email, sort of text message type communications, kind of tweets, all those different ways that we sort of message each other and we kind of share thoughts and ideas and written thoughts, bringing that all into one place and having it available to, for group sharing, for group work, was kind of an interesting idea and a good way to go. And in fact, I actually think that Facebook learned something from this.
Yeah, they probably did, didn't they? And their new messaging,
right? Their new messaging system, where they're going to kind of bring all that stuff together. But what they're going to do is they're going to do it in a way that's kind of accessible, and that's going to be easy for everybody to grok, not just the uber geeks. So so I do think there's a nugget of an idea there. I just think it was this is an example where Google tends to leave things up to the engineers, and sometimes the engineers build things that only an engineer could love.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me wonder about things like Chrome OS, which I'm sure will be a big story in 2011, or maybe it won't. Maybe it'll be the big flop of 2011, but they do commit large resources to big ideas, but they, more than anyone, they're very willing to kill things off. And I guess this is just an echo of what you were just discussing, Tom, with Flickr Commons and other online resources that are hosted by companies not trustworthy. Well, Wave will live on, and we will follow it along with Apache Droids and Apache Wookiee, which I don't know what Apache Wookiee is, but I'm excited by it.
I'm actually hoping I never find out what that is.
Right. I'm wondering, CHNM, people that might not know, but one of our big rooms was actually occupied by intelligent standalone robots. So I'm wondering if they were actually running on Apache Droids. We'll have to ask them. Now they've been banished. We took over. They were slow and very not Battlestar Galactica-like, so we were able to evict them at a quarter mile an hour. Okay, let's move on from depressing stories to uplifting one. Big stories of 2010. Let's start with you, Amanda.
Big stories of 2010.
Yeah, what's your choice? What do you think
all
is number?
I would say ebooks and e-readers.
Good choice.
It's a whole kind of phalanx of stories, but had the launch of the iPad and the iBook store in April, launch of Google ebooks just last week. Mm-hmm. I was actually doing a little, I don't know if you could call it research, but Googling on just the pricing of the Kindle. Back when the Kindle launched back in 2007, it was $399, and you can get it for $139 today. And plus, there's competitors, but like the Nook for like $149. So, e-readers have really, I think, gone into the mainstream. And there's still some, interesting, competition going on between which e-reader and DRM of e-books and all that. But I guess the other thing I have to say that's kind of interesting to me about the rise of ebooks this past year is, so before the rise of e-readers, there were such things as ebooks, but they were, books that you would read on your computer. Libraries would subscribe to things like NetLibrary. They still do that.
Right.
And those really didn't have, they were not widely adopted. They were not convenient to read, all those sorts of things. So there have been ebooks around for a long time. But what I thought was kind of interesting about 2010 was that while we did see the rise of the e-reader and of ebook stores where you can buy books specifically for the e-reader, we also saw a lot. I think we're seeing books on the web as well. Like, I'm not sure that I almost think that like the ebooks on e-readers might almost be a little bit of a gateway drug to books on the web. I'm just happy to see that the rise of the e-reader hasn't totally killed the notion of books available in a browser. So that's kind of interesting to me, and that I think is just a huge story.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty remarkable how quickly this transition was made. I mean, even just the market share of ebooks versus paper and print books is really astonishing in 2010. And I certainly know from, you know, seeing family at Thanksgiving and talking on the phone with people that, a lot of people I wouldn't expect are, you know, asking me about, you know, well, should they get a Kindle? Should they get an iPad? What's the difference? What's the, you know, what's better for reading? It's really taken over at least the mental space, the mental share of interest. And I think that's going to accelerate in 2011, won't it?
I think I read that in 2009, 3% of total book sales were e-books. In 2010, it was 9%. So that's a 300% increase.
Right.
Yes. It's amazing.
And in 2011, they think it's going to be 20%, which is actually a conservative estimate. So, talking about it, one fifth of all books over the course of 3 years.
That's really rapid.
That's amazing.
CDs and DVDs didn't have that kind of adoption rate. I mean, it's astonishing.
And, you know, a tiny little story that came out in 2010, which I'm not sure we covered on the podcast, but the New York Times really recently started including ebooks in its bestsellers list. They used to kind of track them separately. Like, if you publish, an e-edition, an ebook edition, that's allowed to be considered for the New York Times bestsellers list, which it didn't used to be.
Right.
Stuff like that, you know, is fundamentally a changing landscape of the way we read.
Yeah, and I guess it's going to have an impact, as we did talk about on the podcast this year, on libraries and their purchasing decisions. And, you know, will they end up being just subscribers to giant ebook databases, or will they continue to enhance their physical stacks and book sales? Certainly going to have a huge, huge impact. And I think we can definitely say that 2010 was the year that this broke.
Absolutely.
Mills, what's your top story of 2010?
Okay, so my top story for the year is the rise of Android as a really reasonable competitor to the whole Apple, App Store and all of that. Listeners to the podcast know I fought off the desire for an iPhone for many years and waited and waited, and sure enough, Android came along, and so I got one. And why did I get one? Well, largely because I'm locked into my Verizon account with Fios and everything else, but I have been really happy with the service, and in the sense that I like having the apps, and it's been nice for me personally, but also I think, Dan, you and I were talking about this at lunch yesterday. It's going to be very interesting to see when other services than AT&T adopt the or allowed to sell the iPhone, what that's going to do as well. But the main thing is that there's now competition, and I think competition is good in this marketplace. I don't think it matters which service has more apps available in their app store, because there are already too many. And so there are way more apps than anyone could ever possibly think of wanting in their lives. And so I think that competition has been really good. I think it's going to force Apple to continue to get better. I think it forces the folks doing Android things to get better. So all in all, I think it's been a really positive development.
Yeah. We didn't actually end up seeing what I think we predicted last year for Android, which was I think we were excited about it because of its openness and the possibility that there could be Android devices that, you could use in the classroom because they were unlocked. You didn't have to pay a monthly fee for them. We didn't get the, Android equivalent of the iPod Touch this year, did we? Or
no.
Some kind of, I guess we started to get Android tablets.
Right. The big one of those is the Galaxy Tab, which is still tied to a T-Mobile contract. But I think,
It's expensive. In terms of what we were talking about, is a cheap
CES,
kind of
though,
touch device
the classroom. Yeah, at CES in January, the Consumer Electronics Show, I think we're going to see a ton of new Android tablets and smaller devices drop. And I think 2011 is going to be the year of the Android tablet. I think we're just going to see.
Oh, now you're getting into predictions now.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. There's going to be tons of them.
Well, can I just mention something about that too, though? Is coming back to my story, my big story, one interesting thing that has happened this year is the rise of phones as e-readers, right? You know, so, and that's actually been really interesting to me too, like particularly because Kindle, I think, did it exactly right, where they had a Kindle app for, which you can get, I think, for Android as well as for iPhone. So, you know, and it's kind of amazing that those don't compete, right? You can use your phone as an e-reader and or still get an e-reader. So that's one of the important applications that you
Well, there's actually, you know, there's even more convergence. One of the interesting things about e-readers is the one of the new developments is the launch of the Nook, the color Nook, which is, in fact, an Android tablet. It's a full color touch screen. It doesn't have a keyboard or anything. It's running on Android, and the word is that it's going to get Android 2.2 Froyo updated, the full OS, in January. So the Nook is now kind of pushing into the tablet space, and it's a nice little device. I know my sister-in-law has one. And so I think we're going to start to, and I think, you know, we saw that with the iPad too. It's kind of pushing into the Kindle's territory. And I think it's going to force the Kindle to kind of converge too. So I think we're seeing a lot of convergence. And I think it's because of all this competition and because of the rise of Android, which is now outselling. Android phones are outselling iPhones. And so, you know, that's as Mill said, I think that's just good for innovation. That's just good for consumers. That's just good for everybody.
Okay. Well, Tom, why don't we stick with you? What was your big story of 2010?
My big story, you know, is something that is probably of more narrow interest, but certainly of tremendous interest, I think, to this community, our audience, is the Library of Congress's acquisition of Twitter.
Big
remember
story.
If you can remember back to, I guess, June or July.
If only it were interesting to all the members of the podcast.
I keep really wanting to do all kinds of research with Twitter, which I can't because I can't get access to the archive.
Yeah. I think it's just a major recognition of the place in society that social networking technologies and the web really have taken. And so I think, you know, I think the Library of Congress made a big splash with the announcement, but I think it reflects a broader commitment that I think is that the Library of Congress has had to preserving internet, web, and digital content through their NDIP program, I think it's just a further recognition of the importance of electronic communications and the electronic life. So I think it's going to be an even bigger story when we have access to it and humanists are able to start and social scientists are able to start doing some research on the corpus, whatever that looks like.
Well, and we talked a little bit last time about how WikiLeaks might change the face of scholarship by emboringing diplomatic communications, you know, making it making diplomats less likely to communicate that way, but
That coinage.
Yeah, it's really difficult to say. I actually don't recommend it, but we have such, you know, the rise of archives like this Twitter archive. I mean, just think about how that's going to change historical research in the future. I mean, that's just insane to think about.
Yep. Okay. And I wonder if now they could step in and grab those delicious links before those go away. Probably not, but it seems like there's a bunch of these services. I mean, Facebook probably being the number one thing that will lose quite a bit of history if that goes offline. Thinking about the downsides of the cloud. Well, my number one choice is the obvious choice, which is it's the iPad, people. Has to be the number one story of 2010. And I think maybe the iPad as a symbol of a lot of what we were just discussing. You know, it was the Swiss Army knife of touch computing. It did e-reading, it did apps, and I think the rise of app stores is probably a part B of this, that the importance of apps and what this might mean for higher ed and applications for higher ed. All of this was implied in the magical box that Steve Jobs dropped on us in January, although we didn't get our hands on it until April. But I think it was, you know, surely we'll look back and see it. This was a really major time. I think really what happens with Apple devices like this, as it happened with the iPod, is somehow they kind of magically bring together a lot of things that are in the air, and they put it into an attractive packaging that's a consumer packaging. And I think that's why it had this effect as a kind of catalyst for touch computing, app computing, e-reading, lots of things. I think there's probably a lot of people who see an iPad ad and then go buy a Kindle because they see, you know, the iBooks ad on it. So I think it just had this sort of effect of increasing the activity in all these areas. And I think it really was the device that changed so many or implied future change in so many areas in academia, libraries and museums. I'm sure that there are lots of museum iPad apps out there now, and there'll be more in the future. I can see them being used in a lot of different ways. So I think just the imagination that one has when one sees the blank canvas of the tablet was really crystallized in the iPad. And for me, I think that's got to be the top story of 2010.
Yeah, and I don't mind saying that I was about 80% sure that the iPad would tank a little bit. And so I
interesting.
I don't know if I ever opined such in public, but so I was very wrong on that. And I've been I guess one of the things that has surprised me about the popularity of the iPad and all the Me Too tablets that are coming along, because I think it's not too much to say that we wouldn't have things like the Galaxy Tab if we didn't have the iPad. One of the things that has surprised me about that has been that to me they're such consumer devices,
right?
In the literal way, not just, you know, that they're for the consumer market, but that to me they're really not very good input devices. And in fact, you know, calling the iPad a tablet to begin with, before we heard what the iPad really was, people were imagining it would be a thing with a stylus, you know, where you get to write on it and have handwriting recognition or something like that, you know, which there had been versions of that before. And it's not that at all. It's a reading device. It's a, you know, yes, you can do a little bit of email on it and so on. So I may even, as I say, I'm not wanting to buy an iPad for that reason, but I have a feeling that I may not have played with it enough, and that once I go and play with it some more, I may be converted to that.
Right. I mean, for me, it just became my kind of evening couch device, and most significantly for reading. And I think where it excelled over something like a Kindle, which I admit is a very good reading device and is considerably lighter, and I do have like carpal tunnels now from holding my iPad all evening. It had enough of the apps like newspaper apps, The Guardian, BBC, NPR, you know, very solid New York Times app, although it crashes all the time, which is rather annoying. But then apps like Instapaper, which really I think are the really revolutionary part of the iPad, where you can send any bit of text, whether it's an academic article or a blog post or a newspaper piece or a magazine piece, you could send them all to your Instapaper queue, and it really formats them in this sort of really beautiful, almost invisible design, but that your eye reads as a piece of paper with a slight curl to it. And it really just gets reading right on this kind of a device. And so for me, it kind of automatically assembled a nice chunk of reading for the evening, and allowed me to kind of phase out some, but not all, as my Twitter account will attest, some of the kind of background noise, particularly email. And I think the fact that it wasn't a windowing system, I think everyone was thinking, and I think certainly in the Android community, people were thinking in terms of devices with windows on it. And I think the real breakthrough was that the iOS team decided to maximize everything, just like on the iPhone, so that you can't see the edges of other windows, like your Gmail window, when you're reading. You're really immersed in the device, and it feels just like a piece of glass. So I think there's a lot going on with the device that was pretty important. And well, I think the price was important, too, to really mainstream it.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, its effect on libraries, archives, museums, and universities is yet to be determined. There's a couple of pilot programs with the iPad at a couple of universities. But, you know, it's I still don't think it's a much more mainstream device than I would have thought, especially given the price. But I don't think we're seeing wide student adoption of it yet. But I think that two trends that the iPad represents that will definitely have a big impact on higher education are that touchscreen computing and then also that, I suppose you could call it just the tablet/mobile revolution, you know, where you have these devices that are bigger than your phone, but not as big as your laptop. And there seems to be a real, real market for that, you know.
Right.
And so that I think is going to continue to be big.
Right. Okay. The big stories of 2010 from the digital campus team. Let's move on to predictions. Always my favorite part of the year-end wrap up. Amanda, what is your big prediction for 2011? Drum roll, please.
My prediction for 2011 is that the Berkman Center's planning initiative for the National Public Library of America will continue to plan all through 2011.
You're planning on planning.
Oh, I'm so in agreement with that.
Yeah, I think that I think it's marvelous. Don't get me wrong, but it's a slightly snarky way of saying I don't think that much is going to come out of it in 2011, you know, maybe later. But I think that there are such big thorny issues to be addressed with regard to building this National Public Library of America in copyright works. Yes or no? If yes, how? Some kind of technical infrastructure for delivering this, right? That's a huge decision and huge implementation. You know what? I think another big issue that the planners are going to be planning to discuss is whether or not the National Public Library of America will include only books.
Right. Key question.
I've been involved with the Digital Library Federation. I've been following their activities for a long time. And one thing I can tell you is that, when I have asked, what is a digital library? You get a lot of different responses as to whether that includes things like archival collections, or is it only books? So what this library will include, what its scope will be in terms of digital content is going to be a really huge decision. I don't know if anybody would like to join me in attempting to predict what the URL of the National Public Library of America will be. I did some Googling to try to find out, you know, some likely ones. So I did some domain lookups and some whoises. So digitallibrary.org is already owned by the New York Public Library. It's not being used.
Interesting.
Nationalpubliclibrary.org is owned by a grad student in human computer interaction at Purdue, if it's the same guy. My favorite URL, the one that I hope it has, is library.gov.
Nice.
It doesn't go anywhere. Yeah. It's just parked. It's some Time Warner parked thing.
Yeah, but this is would this be a government entity?
Right. That's
well,
that's
the National Archives and the LC are, you know, on the planning committee. They're heavily involved in the planning committee. And I will say too that, you know, some of the critique of this has been that, you know, despite its name, the National Public Library of America, they're not really including public libraries per se. I mean, New York Public Library and Boston Library, that's one thing. I mean, they've both got members who are involved, at least, in
they're
the
not
project.
Public libraries in the way that some other libraries are.
Exactly,
libraries.
Right.
They're
so,
private public libraries.
They're right. Big research libraries. So this
and
is
they're
an
not, and they're not government funded. They're,
yeah.
They're private
right.
libraries.
Are they both? Yeah.
Well, yeah. They're of, you know, one of, I think they're two of maybe the only, but they're not run by the city of Boston and the city of New York. They're private, you know, private public foundations, but they're not government organizations.
Well, I would love for there to be something that is government organized and promoted. And actually, if it were me, if I were on the planning committee, I would say do only books, do only public domain for now. You know, deal with copyright later. Just, you know, set up library.gov and put up a bunch, you know, and there's plenty, you know, Gutenberg.org and the Internet Archive, all those places. There's plenty of places where you can get free public domain ebooks now, Google ebooks. But I think it's important for us as a country to commit to this ideal that Robert Darnton has been publicizing so well, that, you know, we need to commit to the principle that our citizens deserve access to free information.
Okay. We will. This is certainly something we're going to be talking about, I can tell, in 2011. And we'll see where it goes. I'm having trouble imagining in the age of the Tea Party getting government funding for this. But maybe in the second Palin administration.
It's anti-American, Dan. Don't you know that?
It's socialist.
You didn't even catch my second Palin administration. All right. Okay. I'm trying my best here as host. Okay. Mills, what is your prediction for 2011?
My prediction for 2011 is that 7 university presses will close.
Oh, wow. Ouch. Thank you for the very specific 7
yes,
university
7.
Presses.
Okay,
will you enumerate them?
No, I do not have a list, but I predict that 7 will close. There are far too many in the marketplace as it is. All or almost all of them are losing money. Mm-hmm. The financial situation of colleges and universities has not improved in 2010 and is probably not going to improve in 2011. And most importantly, Rice University did not close down when Rice University Press closed in the fall of 2010. And so if I'm, you know, on the fiscal side of a university and I'm trying to figure out how we're going to make payroll for the rest of the year, one of the things that I'm looking at is the university press, because although they're not extraordinarily expensive, They're an auxiliary operation to the function of the university. It is not necessary for a university to have a press. And so why can't those other universities absorb the cost of doing this? And we're going to save money. So, and of course, maybe you heard earlier in the podcast, there's a little discussion of ebooks and e-readers and open source materials and all those other things. There never was a strong cost recovery model for university presses, and it's getting worse by the minute instead of better. And so I think the university press by and large is toast. And so I think 7 is the number that we're going to see close their doors in the next 365 days.
Okay. 7 is the over under. Let the wagering begin.
On our website.
I'm thinking of putting a death pool on my blog.
Good idea.
Ouch.
Yeah. I wonder if that domain name's available. I assume you remember the fcompany.com. Eftcompany.com. I will not say the whole word since it's a family podcast.
We need updeathwatch.org.
Yeah, okay.
UPDeathWatch.org. Or maybe .com. I think we can get some.
I like this domain speculation here on the podcast. We should start buying up domains that people will need in the future.
Well, my all-time favorite, many listeners of the podcast know that the Open Society Institute in New York is one of the largest philanthropic organizations in North America, financed largely by the market winnings of George Soros. And if you go to osi.org, you can learn all about swine improvement in Ontario. And in particular, if you go there today, you can register for the Banff Swine Conference in January of 2011.
Oh, gosh, I'm surprised Soros didn't try to buy that with like currency trading shares or something like that.
Yeah. Banff in January is a pretty nice place, though.
All right. Okay, on that note, Tom, what's your prediction for 2011?
So I'm not sure it's a prediction, but it's definitely something I'm going to be watching in 2011. And that's the Gates Foundation and their investment of $20 million in educational technology, particularly technology for higher education. The Gates Foundation, in I guess it was October maybe, at the EDUCAUSE meeting, made an announcement that they are going to be, through EDUCAUSE, putting $20 million, perhaps $20 million a year for 4 years. So it may ultimately be an investment of $80 million into building systems for higher ed. That is, so there's, you know, that in itself is news, but I think in 2011, I want to see what comes of that. I'm interested to see what exactly they're going to fund, because, you know, $20 million in this space is a lot of money. I mean, it puts them very near the top of the table with the Department of Ed and with Hewlett and with MacArthur and with Mellon in funding educational technology. And so they're going to have a big impact, whatever it is. You know, you pour $20 million into our business, it changes things. And so I want to see what those changes are, and I'm going to be keeping an eye on that.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. Certainly is a big chunk of change. So my prediction is a little bit off the wall for 2011, but I'm going to predict the rise of data-driven multilingualism. That's my prediction for 2011.
Can you say that again five times fast?
I was trying to think of the longest prediction I could come up with, and data-driven multilingualism was what I came up with. Just this morning, there was an app for the iPhone only. Sorry, Mills. Where you can wave your iPhone over a menu that's in Spanish, and it reads the letters in Spanish and the words in Spanish and translates it into English. And I know Google is doing a lot on this front too, but they've built up such incredible databases of word and phrase pairs in English-Spanish, all kinds of from to pairs of languages, that I think we're going to see some pretty astonishing changes to the way we interact with people who do not speak our language in 2011. I think there will be services, for instance, in places, and you can already see it start happening, places like Facebook, where you will have auto translation, Twitter. There are already some apps that do rough translations of tweets in languages other than the one you speak. And I think it's going to revolutionize a lot of things we do in the academy. For instance, when we're doing prospecting for research materials and we need to scan the table of contents in a book, I think there'll be ways to auto-translate that material. Google Books, I think, will implement something like this.
I think there's two
I'm getting all choked up by this idea.
Android are Google Translate, so it will translate any piece of text into any language on your Android device, and speech recognition, so that you can speak into any text box, into any text field in Android, in your email or in a document or wherever there's a text box on a website, you can actually hit a little microphone and speak into it, and it will translate that. I can imagine, Dan, I think you're right, I hadn't thought about this, but I can imagine a convergence of those two technologies, so that you would actually speak in your own language. It would recognize that and then automatically translate it and perhaps read it back to a recipient. So you could almost imagine nearly synchronous translated telephone conversations. I think we're getting pretty close to that, where I could be speaking in English to a colleague who is speaking to me in Italian, and we could be hearing each other in our own languages.
It's kind of fascinating because so PhD programs historically, and as far as I know still, require as part of your doctoral education that you learn another language, at least one. At UVA, you had to have reading knowledge of two languages or mastery of one. And, you know, the obvious rationale behind that is that you were going to have to do some reading in languages other than English, and then potentially speak with colleagues from other countries as well. And there was a bit of a movement in the digital humanities field to allow programming languages to be included, you know, partly because they were often so much more useful. I mean, very often, like, their language requirement was the last thing that all my graduate student colleagues did. They were like, oh God, I got to go take Italian classes or something, you know, and they really didn't find a need to use it on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
And since we've seen some language programs getting cut, for instance, at the University of Albany, just down the road from me. I mean, I almost wonder if what the rise of such translation services will have on scholarly requirements and scholarly offerings.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, I think what I was trying to get at with the first part of that very long phrase of the data-driven part is that, you know, Tom was mentioning this, these Android capabilities, and really the way that Google has gone about this is that they ran this free service for a couple of years, 1-800-GOOG-411, where people spoke into their phone requests, and they use that enormous database of English-speaking people with many different kinds of accents to be able to figure out what people were saying, because then it would offer you a bunch.
Everybody wondered why they were doing that.
Right, and now they've launched similar 411 services in several other countries. So again, I think it's the data-driven aspect of it. I think, you know, probably as scholars, you're still going to have to learn French and German if you want to do European history, but to get the nuances. But what they end up getting is pretty good enough translations. And that's what I think is what makes it interesting, just from the huge database they have. Hmm. Well, I think we've done it. I think we have covered all of 2010, or a bit of it, that we
saw. Enough of it.
Tom and Mills and Amanda, it's great, as always, talking with you for this year. I'm looking forward to our fifth year on the podcast, and it's really something that I know I look forward to. I hope our audience looks forward to listening to it, and we're wishing all of you, I think I can speak from all of us, for all of us, that we're wishing all of you a very happy holiday season and a happy new year. If you want to wish us a happy holiday season, one of the ways you can do that is by going and rating our podcast in iTunes. I think we're approaching about 1,000 subscribers to this podcast, and we'd love for even more people to hear about it. And one of the ways that happens on iTunes is that when people rate the podcast, it kind of surfaces more in searches and in iTunes U and other places. So we do appreciate your listening in, and we'll talk to you in the new year on another edition of Digital Campus.
We have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself. Thank you.